like it with her knuckles between her teeth, Jim. And I felt the religion of the physical that day. And I'm much more in your age, Jim. Shoes filling with blood. Held under the arms by two bodies big as yours and dragged off a public court with two extra lines. It's a pivotal, it's a seminal religious day when you get to both hear and feel your destiny at the same moment, Jim. I got to notice what I'm sure you've noticed long ago. I know, and I know you've seen me brought home on occasions. Dragged in the door under what's called the influence, son. Helped in by cabbies at night. I've seen your long shadow grotesquely backlit at the top of the house's stairs. I helped pay for it, boy. How the drunk and the maimed both are dragged forward out of the arena like a boneless Christ, one man under each arm, feet dragging, eyes on the ether. The 4th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. From Cambridge's Latinate Inman Square, Michael Pemulis, nobody's fool at all, rides one necessary bus to Central Square and then an unnecessary bus to Davis Square and a train back to Central. This is to throw off the slightest possible chance of pursuit. At Central, he catches the Red Line to Park Street Station, where he's parked the tow truck in an underground lot he can more than afford. The day is autumnal and mild, the east breeze smelling of urban commerce and the vague suede smell of new fallen leaves. The sky is pilot light blue. Sunlight reflects complexly off the smoked glass sides of tall centers of commerce all around Park Street downtown. Pemulis wears button-fly chinos and an ETA shirt beneath a snazzy blue Brioni sport coat, plus the bright white yachting cap that Mario Incandenza calls his Mr. Howell hat. The hat looks rakish even when turned around, and it has a detachable lining. Inside the lining can be kept portable quantities of just about anything. Having indulged in 150 milligrams of very mild dreams, post-transaction. Wearing also gray and blue saddle oxfords without socks, it's such a mild autumn day. The streets literally bustle. Vendors with carts instead of tubs sell hot pretzels and tonics and those underboiled franks Pemulis likes to have them put the works on. You can see the State House and Common and Courthouse and Public Gardens, and beyond all that, the cool, smooth facades of Back Bay brownstones. The echoes in the underground Park Place garage, park, gark, 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 are pleasantly complex. Traffic westward on Commonwealth Avenue is light, meaning things can move, all the way through Kenmore Square and past Boston U and up the long, slow hill into Alston and Enfield. When Tavis and Shtid and the players and ground crew and Testar and ATH-SCME teams inflate the all-weather lung for the winter over courts 16 through 32, the domed lung's nacelle is visible against the horizon all the way down by the Brighton Avenue-Commonwealth Avenue split in Lower Alston. The incredibly potent DMZ is apparently classed as a paramethoxylated amphetamine. But really it looks to Pemulis, from his slow and tortured survey of the MedCom's monographs, more similar to the anticholinergic deliriant class. Way more powerful than mescaline, or MDA, or DMA, or TMA, or MDMA, or DOM, or STP, or the IV ingestible DMT, or Olaluki, or Datura's scopolamine, or fluethane, or bufotenine, a.k.a. Jackie O, or ebene, or psilocybin, or Sylert.
56.
DMZ resembling chemically some miscegenation of a lysergic with a mesimeloid, but significantly different from LSD-25 in that its effects are less visual and spatially cerebral, and more like temporally cerebral, and almost ontological, with some sort of manipulated phenylkylamine-like speediness whereby the ingester perceives his relation to the ordinary flow of time as radically, and euphorically, is where the mesimal affective resemblance shows its head, altered.
57.
The incredibly potent DMZ is synthesized from a derivative of Fitvayavi, an obscure mold that grows only on other molds, by the same ambivalently lucky chemist at Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, who had first stumbled on LSD as a relatively ephebic and clueless organic chemist while futzing around with ergotic fungi on rye. DMZ's discovery was the tail end of the BS 1960s, just about the same time Dr. Alan Watts was considering T. Leary's invitation to become writer in resonance at Leary's utopian LSD 25 colony in Millbrook, New York, on what is now Canadian soil. A substance even just the accidental synthesis of which sent the Sandoz chemist into early retirement and serious, unblinking wall-watching. The incredibly potent DMZ has a popular lay chemical underground reputation as the single grimmest thing ever conceived in a tube. It is also now the hardest recreational compound to acquire in North America after raw Vietnamese opium, which, forget it. DMZ is sometimes also referred to in some Metro Boston chemical circles as Madam Psychosis, after a popular very early morning cult radio personality on MIT's student-run radio station WYYY 109, largest whole prime on the FM band, which Mario Incandenza and ETA Stats Weenie and Eschaton Game Master Otis P. Lord listened to almost religiously. The day shift Ennett House kid at the booth, who raises the portcullis to let him onto the grounds, had a couple times in October approached Pemulis about a potential transaction. Pemulis has a rigid policy about not transacting with ETA employees who come up the hill from the halfway house, since he knows some of them are at the place on court order, and knows for a fact they pull unscheduled urines all over the place down there. And types like the Ennett House types are just the sorts of people Pemulis's talents let him get away from, in terms of, like, social milieu and mixing and transacting. And his basic attitude with these low-rent employees is one of unfoolish discretion, and, like, why tempt fate? The East courts are empty and ball-strewn when Pemulis pulls in. Most of them are still at lunch. Pemulis, Trolch, and Schacht's triple room is in subdorm B in the back north part of the second floor of West House, and so superjacent to the dining hall, from which, through the floor, Pemulis can hear voices and silverware and can smell exactly what they're having. The first thing he does is boot up the phone console and try Ink and Mario's room over in ComAd, where Hal is sitting in window light with the Riverside Hamlet he told Mario he'd read and help with a conceptual film-type project based on part of his uncushioned captain's chair, partly under an old print of a detail from the minor and softcore Alexandrian mosaic Consummation of the Leverets, eating an AminoPal energy bar and waiting very casually, the phone with its antenna already out lying ready on the arm of the chair, and two folio-sized Barron's SAT prep guides and a spine-shot copy of the BS 1937, Tilden on spin, and his keys on their neck chain lying on the Lindisfarne carpet by his shoe, waiting in a very casual posture. Hal deliberately waits till the audio console's third ring, like a girl at home on Saturday night. Yellow. The turd emergeth. Pemulis's clear and digitally condensed voice on the line. Repeat, the turd emergeth. Please commit a crime, is Hal Incandenza's immediate reply. Gracious me, Pemulis says into the phone tucked under his jaw, carefully de-velcroing the lining of his Mr. Howell hat. Tennis and the Feral Prodigy, narrated by Hal Incandenza. An 11.5-minute digital entertainment cartridge, directed, recorded, edited, and, according to the entry form, written by Mario Incandenza, in receipt of New England Regional Honorable Mention in Interlace Tell Entertainment's annual New Eyes, New Voices Young Filmmakers Contest. April, in the year of the You Shit You, 2007, Mimetic Resolution Cartridge View Motherboard, easy-to-install upgrade for Infernitron Interlace TP systems for home, office, or mobile. Almost exactly 3 years after Dr. James O. Incandenza passed from this life. Here is how to put on a big red tent of a shirt that has ETA across the chest in gray. Please ease carefully into your supporter and adjust the elastic straps so the straps do not bite into your butt and make bulged ridges in your butt that everyone can see once you've sweated through your shorts. Here is how to wrap your torn ankle so tightly in its flesh-toned ace bandages your left leg feels like a log. Here is how to win later. This is a yellow iron mesh ball hopper full of dirty green dead old balls. Take them to the east courts while the dawn is still chalky and no one's around except the morning doves that infest the pines at sunrise, and the air is so soft you can see your summer breath. It serves to no one. Make a mess of balls along the base of the opposite fence as the sun hauls itself up over the harbor, and a thin sweat breaks and the surf start to boom. Stop thinking and let it flow and go boom, boom. The shiver off the ball against the opposite fence. Hit about 1,000 serves to no one while himself sits and advises with his flask. Older men's legs are white and hairless from decades in pants. Here is a set of keys a stride's length before you in the court as you serve dead balls to no one. After each serve, you must almost fall forward into the court and in one smooth motion bend and scoop up the keys with your left hand. This is how to train yourself to follow through into the court after the serve. You still, years after the man's death, cannot keep your keys anywhere but on the floor. This is how to hold the stick. Learn to call the racket a stick. Everyone does here. It's a tradition. The stick. Something so much an extension of you deserves a sobriquet. Please look. You'll be shown exactly once how to hold it. This is how to hold it. Just like this. Forget all the Near Eastern slice backhand grip baffle gab. Just say hello is all. You shake hands with the calfskin grip of the stick. This is how to hold it. The stick is your friend. You will become very close. Grasp your friend firmly at all times. A firm grip is essential for both control and power. Here is how to carry a tennis ball around in your stick hand, squeezing it over and over for long stretches of time. In class, on the phone, in lab, in front of the TP, a wet ball for the shower, ideally squeezing it at all times except during meals. See the Academy dining hall, where tennis balls sit beside every plate. Squeeze the tennis ball rhythmically month after year until you feel it no more than your heart squeezing blood and your right forearm is 3 times the size of your left and your arm looks from across a court like a gorilla's arm or a stevedore's arm pasted on the body of a child. Here is how to do extra individual drills before the Academy's AM drills, before breakfast, so that after the 1,000th ball hit just out of reach by himself, with his mammoth wingspan and ghastly calves, urging you with nothing but smiles on to great and greater demonstrations of effort, so that after you've gotten your 3rd and final wind and must vomit, there is little inside to vomit, and the spasms pass quickly, and an east breeze blows cooler past you, and you feel clean and can breathe. Here is how to don red and gray ETA sweats and squad jog a weekly 40 kilometer up and down urban Commonwealth Avenue, even though you would rather set your hair on fire than jog in a pack. Jogging is painful and pointless, but you are not in charge. Your brother gets to ride shotgun while a senile German blows BBs at your legs, both of them laughing and screaming, "Schnell!" Enfield is due east of the marathon's Hills of Heartbreak, which are just up Commonwealth, past the reservoir in Newton. Urban jogging in a sweaty pack is tedious. Half himself hunched down to put a long pale arm around your shoulders, and tell you that his own father had told him that talent is sort of a dark gift. The talent is its own expectation. It is there from the start and either lived up to or lost. Have a father whose own father lost what was there. Have a father who lived up to his own promise and then found thing after thing to meet and surpass the expectations of his promise in, and didn't seem just a whole hell of a lot happier or tighter wrapped than his own failed father, leaving you yourself in a kind of feral and flux-ridden state with respect to talent. Here is how to avoid thinking about any of this by practicing and playing until everything runs on autopilot and talent's unconscious exercise becomes a way to escape yourself, a long waking dream of pure play. The irony is that this makes you very good, and you start to become regarded as having a prodigious talent to live up to. Here is how to handle being a feral prodigy. Here is how to handle being seated at tournaments, signifying that seating committees composed of old, big-armed men publicly expect you to reach a certain round. Reaching at least the round you're supposed to is known at tournaments as justifying your seed. By repeating this term over and over, perhaps in the same rhythm at which you squeeze a ball, you can reduce it to an empty series of phonemes, just formants and fricatives, trochaically stressed, signifying zip. Here is how to beat unseeded, wide-eyed opponents from Iowa or Rhode Island in the early rounds of tournaments without expending much energy, but also without seeming contemptuous. This is how to play with personal integrity in a tournament's early rounds when there is no umpire. Any ball that lands on your side and is too close to call, call it fair. Here is how to be invulnerable to gamesmanship, to keep your attention's aperture tight. Here is how to teach yourself when an opponent maybe cheats on the line calls, to remind yourself that what goes around comes around, that a poor sport's punishment is always self-inflicted. Try to learn to let what is unfair teach you. Here is how to spray yourself down exactly once with Lemon Pledge, the ultimate sunscreen, then discover that when you go out and sweat into it, it smells like close-order skunk. Here is how to take non-narcotic muscle relaxants for the back spasms that come from thousands of serves to no one. Here is how to weep in bed trying to remember when your torn blue ankle didn't hurt every minute. This is the whirlpool. A friend. Here is how to set up the electric ball machine at dawn on the days himself is away, living up to what will be his final talent. Here is how to tie a bow tie. Here is how to sit through small openings of your father's first art films, surrounded by surly foreign cigarette smoke and conversations so pretentious you literally cannot believe them. You're sure you have misheard them. Pretend you're engaged by the jagged angles and multiple exposures without pretending you have the slightest idea what's going on. Assume your brother's expression. Here is how to sweat. Here is how to hand a trophy to lateral Alice Moore to put in the ETA lobby's glass case under its system of spotlights and small signs. What is unfair can be a stern but invaluable teacher. Here is how to pack carbohydrates into your tissues for a 4 singles, 2 doubles match day in a Florida June. Please, learn to sleep with perpetual sunburn. Expect some rough dreams. They come with the territory. Try to accept them. Let them teach you. Keep a flashlight by your bed. It helps with the dreams. Please make no extramural friends. Discourage advances from outside the circuit. Turn down dates. If you do exactly the rehabilitative exercises they assign you, no matter how silly and tedious, the ankle will mend more quickly. This type of stretch helps prevent the groin pull. Treat your knees and elbow with all reasonable care. You will have them with you for a long time. Here is how to turn down an extramural date so you won't be asked again. Say something like, I'm terribly sorry, I can't come out to see 8½ revived on a wall-size Cambridge Celluloid Festival viewer on Friday, Kimberly, or Daphne, but you see, if I jump rope for 2 hours, then jog backwards through Newton till I puke, they'll let me watch match cartridges, and then my mother will read aloud to me from the OED until 2200 lights out, and see. So you can be sure that henceforth, Daphne, Kimberly, Jennifer will take her adolescent mating dance type ritual socialization business somewhere else. Be on guard. The road widens and many of the detours are seductive. Be constantly focused and on alert. Feral talent is its own set of expectations and can abandon you at any one of the detours of so-called normal American life at any time. So be on guard. Here is how to schnell. Here is how to go through your normal adolescent growth spurt and have every limb in your body ache like a migraine because selected groups of muscles have been worked until thick and intensile, and they resist as the sudden growth of bone tries to stretch them, and they ache all the time. There is medication for this condition. If you are an adolescent, here is the trick to being neither quite a nerd nor quite a jock. Be no one. It is easier than you think. Here is how to read the monthly ETA and USTA and ONANTA rankings the way himself read scholars' reviews of his multiple exposure melodramas. Learn to care and not to care. They mean the rankings to help you determine where you are, not who you are. Memorize your monthly rankings and forget them. Here is how. Never tell anyone where you are. This is also how not to fear sleep or dreams. Never tell anyone where you are. Please, learn the pragmatics of expressing fear. Sometimes words that seem to express really invoke. This can be tricky. Here is how to get free sticks and strings and clothes and gear from Dunlop Incorporated, as long as you let them spray paint the distinctive Dunlop logo on your sticks, strings, and so logos on your shoulder, and the left pocket of your shorts, and use a Dunlop gear bag, and you become a walking, lunging, sweating advertisement for Dunlop Incorporated. This is all as long as you keep justifying your seed and preserving your rank. The Dunlop Incorporated new New England regional athletic rep will address you as our gray swan. He wears designer slacks and choking cologne, and about twice a year wants to help you dress, and has to be slapped like a gnat. Be a student of the game. Like most cliches of sport, this is profound. You can be shaped, or you can be broken. There is not much in between. Try to learn. Be coachable. Try to learn from everybody, especially those who fail. This is hard. Peers who fizzle, or blow up, or fall down, run away, disappear from the monthly rankings, drop off the circuit. ETA peers waiting for DeLint to knock quietly at their door and ask to chat. Opponents. It's all educational. How promising you are as a student of the game is a function of what you can pay attention to without running away. Nets and fences can be mirrors. And between the nets and fences, opponents are also mirrors. This is why the whole thing is scary. This is why all opponents are scary, and weaker opponents are especially scary. See yourself in your opponents. They will bring you to understand the game, to accept the fact that the game is about managed fear, that its object is to send from yourself what you hope will not return. This is your body. They want you to know. You will have it with you, always. On this issue, there is no counsel. You must make your best guess. For myself, I do not expect ever really to know. But in the interval, if it is an interval, Here is Motrin for your joints, Noxema for your burn, Lemon Pledge if you prefer nausea to burn, Contracol for your back, Benzoin for your hands, Epsom salts and anti-inflammatories for your ankle, and extracurriculars for your folks, who just wanted to make sure you didn't miss anything they got. Selected transcripts of the Resident Interface Drop-In Hours of Ms. Patricia Montesian, M.A., CSAC, Executive Director, Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House, Enfield, Massachusetts, 1300 to 1500 hours, Wednesday, 4 November, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment.
58.
But there's this way he drums his fingers on the table. Not even like really drumming. More like in way between drumming and like this scratching, picking. The way you see somebody picking at dead skin. And without any kind of rhythm, see? Constant and never stopping, but with no kind of rhythm you could grab onto and follow and stand. Totally like whacked, insane. Like the kind of sounds you can imagine a girl hears in her head right before she kills her whole family because somebody took the last bit of peanut butter or something. You know what I'm saying? The sound of a fucking mind coming apart. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, yes. Okay, the short answer is, when he wouldn't quit with the drumming at supper, I sort of poked him with my fork. Sort of. I could see how maybe somebody could have thought I sort of stabbed him. I offered to get the fork out, though. Let me just say I'm ready to make amends at, like, any time. For my part in it. I'm owning my part in it, is what I'm saying. Can I ask, am I going to get restricted for this? 'Cause I have this overnight tomorrow that Gene, he approved already in the overnight log, if you want to look. But I'm not trying to get out of owning my part of the, like, occurrence. If my higher power, who I choose to call God, works through you, saying I've got some kind of a punishment due, I won't try to get out of a punishment. If I've got one due. I just wanted to ask. Did I mention I'm grateful to be here?
I am not denying anything. I'm simply asking you to define alcoholic. How can you ask me to attribute to myself a given term if you refuse to define the term's meaning? I've been a reasonably successful personal injury attorney for 16 years, and except for that one ridiculous so-called seizure at the Bar Association dinner this spring, and that clot of a judge banning me from his courtroom, and let me just say that I can support my contention that the man masturbates under his robe behind the bench with detailed corroboration from both colleagues and circuit court laundry personnel. With the exception of less than a handful of incidents, I've held my liquor and my head as high as many a taller advocate. Believe you me. How old are you, young lady? I'm not in denial, so to speak, about anything empirical and objective. Am I having pancreas problems? Yes. Do I have trouble recalling certain intervals in the Kemp and Limbaugh administrations? No contest. Is there a spot of domestic turbulence surrounding my intake? Why, yes, there is. Did I experience, yes, some formication and detox? I did. I have no problem forthrightly admitting things I can grasp. Formicate, with an M, yes. But what is this you demand I admit? Is it denial to delay signature until the vocabulary of the contract is clear to all parties so bound? Yes, yes, you don't follow what I mean here. Good, and you're reluctant to proceed without clarification. I rest. I cannot deny what I don't understand. This is my position. So I'm sitting there waiting for my meatloaf to cool, and suddenly there's a simply sphincter-loosening shriek. And here's Nell in the air with a steak fork, positively aloft, leaping across the table, in flight, horizontal. I mean, Pat, the girl's body is literally parallel to the surface of the table, hurling herself at me with his upraised fork, shrieking something about the sound of peanut butter. I mean, my God! Galen Deal,
Had to pull the fork out of my hand and the tabletop both, to give you an idea of the savagery. Don't even ask me about the pain. Let's don't even get into that, I assure you. They offered me Percocet at the emergency room is all I'll say about the levels of pain involved.
59.
I told them I was in recovery and powerless over narcotics of any sort. Please don't even ask me how moved they were at my courage if you don't want me to get weepy. This whole experience has me right on the edge of a complete hysterical fit. So, but yes, guilty. I may very well have been tapping on the table. Excuse me for occupying space. And then she ever so magnanimously says she'll apologize if I will. Well, come again, I said. Come again? I mean, my God! I'm sitting there attached to the table by tines! I know bashing, Pat. And this was unabashed bashing. At its most fascist. I respectfully ask that she be kicked out of here on her enormous rear end. Let her go back to whatever fork-wielding district she came from, with her hefty bag full of gauche clothes. Honestly, I know part of this process is learning to live in a community, to give and take, to let go of personality issues, turn them over, etc. But is it not also supposed to be, and here I quote the handbook, a safe and nurturing environment? I have seldom felt less nurtured than I did impaled on that table, I have to say. The pathetic harassments of Minty and McDade are bad enough. I can get bashed back at the Fenway. I did not come here to get bashed on some pretense of table tapping. I'm dangerously close to saying either that specimen goes, or I do.
I'm awful sorry to bother. I can come back. I was wondering if maybe there was any special program prayer for when you want to hang yourself.
I want understanding. I have no denial. I am drug addict. Me, I know I am addicted since the period of before Miami. I am no trouble to stand up in the meetings and say I am Alfonso. I am drug addict, powerless. I am knowing powerlessness since the period of Castro. But I cannot stop even since I know. This I have fear. I fear I do not stop when I admit I am Alfonso. Powerless. How does to admit I am powerless make me stop what the thing is I am powerless to stop? My head, it is crazy from this fearing of no power. I am now hope for power, Mrs. Pat. I want to advise. Is hope of power the bad way for Alfonso? Astrog addict?
Sorry to barge there. PM division called again about the thing with the vermin. The word was ultimatum that they said.
Sorry if I'm bothering you about something that isn't a straightforward treatment interface thing. I'm up there trying to do my chore. I've got the men's upstairs bathroom. There's something... Pat, there's something in the toilet up there that won't flush. The thing, it won't go away. It keeps reappearing, flush after flush. I'm only here for instructions, possibly also protective equipment. I couldn't even describe the thing in the toilet. All I can say is, if it was produced by anything human, then I have to say I'm really worried. Don't even ask me to describe it. If you want to go up and have a look, I'm 100% confident it's still there. It's made it real clear it's not going anywhere. All I know is I put a Hunt's pudding cup in the resident fridge like I'm supposed to at 1300 and da-da-da, and at 1430 I come down all prime for pudding that I paid for myself, and it's not there. And McDade comes on all concerned and offers to help me look for it and da-da, except if you look, I look, and here's the son of a whore got this big thing of pudding on his chin.
Yeah, but except so how can I answer just yes or no to do I want to stop the coke? Do I think I want to? Absolutely I think I want to. I don't have a septum no more. My septum's been, like, fucking dissolved by coke, see? You see anything like a septum when I lift up like that? I've absolutely, with my whole heart, thought I wanted to stop and so forth, and ever since with the septum. Since I've been wanting to stop this whole time, why couldn't I stop? You see what I'm saying? Isn't it all about wanting to, and so on, and so forth? How can living here and going to meetings and all do anything except make me want to stop? But I think I already want to stop. How come I'd even be here if I didn't want to stop? Isn't being here proof I want to stop? But then, so, how come I can't stop if I want to stop, is the thing.
This kid had a hair lip, where it goes like, you know, fifth. But his went way up, further up. He sold bad speed, but good pot. He said he'd cover our part of the rent if we kept his snakes supplied with mice. We were smoking up all our cash, so what's to do? They ate mice. We had to go into pet stores and pretend to be really heavily into mice. Snakes. He kept snakes. Deucey. Smelt bad. He never cleaned the tanks. His lip covered his nose. The hair lip? I guess he couldn't smell what they smelled like, or something would have got done. He had a thing for Mildred, my girlfriend? I don't know. She probably has a problem, too. I don't know. He had a thing for her. He'd keep saying shit like, with all these THs, he'd go, "Foe, you want to fuck me, Mildred, or what? We don't have to eat each other or nothing." He'd say shit like this with me right there, dropping mice into these tanks, holding my breath. The mice had to be alive. All in this god-awful voice like somebody's holding their nose and can't say S. He didn't wash his hair for 2 years. We had like an in-joke on how long he wouldn't wash his hair, and we'd make X's on the calendar every week. We had a lot of these in-type jokes to help us stand it. We were wasted, I'd say, 90% of the time. 9-0. But he never did the whole time we were there. Wash. When she said we had to leave or she was taking off and taking Harriet was when she said, when I was at work, he started telling her how to have sex with a chicken. He said he had sex with the chickens. It was a trailer out past the dumpster dock in the spur, and he kept a couple chickens under it. And one of them ran like hell when anybody came. He'd been, like, sexually abusing fowls. He kept talking to her about it, with all THs, like, you have to, like, screw them on. But when you come, they just sort of fly off of you. She said she drew the line. We left and went to Pine Street Shelter, and she stayed for a while till this guy with a hat said he had a ranch in New Jersey. And off she goes, and with Harriet. Harriet's our daughter. She's going to be 3. She says it's free, though. I doubt now the kid will ever say a single TH her whole life. I don't even know where in New Jersey. Does New Jersey even have ranches? I've been in school with her since grade school. Mildred. We were like childhood sweethearts. And then this guy who got her old cot at the shelter I got lice from. He moves into her cot and then I start to get lice. I was still trying to deliver ice to machines at gas stations. I wouldn't have to get high just to stand it.
So this purports to be a disease, alcoholism. A disease, like a cold, or like cancer. I have to tell you, I have never heard of anyone being told to pray for relief from cancer. Outside maybe certain very rural parts of the American South, that is. So what is this? You're ordering me to pray? Because I allegedly have a disease? I dismantle my life and career and enter 9 months of low-income treatment for a disease and I'm prescribed prayer? Does the word retrograde signify? Am I in a socio-historical era I don't know about? What exactly is the story here?
Fine, fine, fine. Just completely fine. No problem at all. Happy to be here. Feeling better. Sleeping better. Love the chow. In a word, couldn't be finer. The grinding? The tooth grinding? A tick. A jaw strengthener. Expression of all-around fineness. Likewise, the thing with the eyelid.
But I did too try. I've been trying all month. I've been on 4 interviews. And then none of them start till 11. And I'm like, what's the point? Get up early, sit around here. I don't have to be down there till 11. I fill out applications every day. Where am I supposed to go? You can't kick me out just for the month. They don't call me back if I'm trying. It's not my fault. Go on and ask Clinette. Ask that Thrale girl and them if I ain't been trying. You can. This is just so fucked up. I said, where am I supposed to go to?
I'm on a month's full house restriction for using freaking mouthwash. Newsflash, news bulletin. Mouthwash is for spitting out. It's like 2% proof.
It's about somebody else's farting. Why I'm here.
I'll gladly identify myself if you'll first simply explain what it is I'm identifying myself as. This is my position. You're requiring me to attest to facts I do not possess. The term for this is duress.
So my offense is what? Misdemeanor gargling?
I'll come back when you're free.
It's back. For a second there, I hoped. I had hope. Then, there it was again.
First, just let me say one thing.
Late October, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment.
Open me another one of those, boy, and I'll tell you the highlight of that season of my season tickets. Was I got to see that incredible son of a bitch set his first record in the flesh. It was your brother's Cub Scout Twoop outing. You wouldn't join because I remember this. You were afraid you'd lose the online time in front of the TP. Remember? Well, I'll always remember this one day, boy. It was against Syracuse. What, 8 seasons back? The little son of a bitch had a long of 73 that day, and an average of 60-friggin-9. 73, for Christ's sake. Open me another one, boy. Use the exercise. I recall the sky was cloudy. When he punted, you spent a real long time studying the sky. They really hung. He had a long hang time of 8.3 seconds that day. That's serious hanging, boy. Me, I never went 5 in my day. Christ. The whole troop said they never heard anything like the sound of the son of a bitch's 73. Juan Wichardson, you remember Juanie, the troop weeder whatever? Petroleum jelly salesman out of Brookline? Juanie's a retired pilot from the service, from a bomber squadron. Juanie, we's down at the pub that night. Juanie says, that 73 sounded just like fucking bomb sounded. That kind of quacking whump when they hit to the boys in the squadron in the planes when they let them go.
The radio show right before Madame Psychosis's midnight show on MIT's semi-underground WYYY is Those Were the Legends That Formerly Were, one of those cruel tech collegiate formats where any U.S. student who wants to can dart over from the Super Collider Lab or the Fourier Transform Study Group for 15 minutes and read on air some parodic thing where he'd pretend to be his own dad, apotheosizing some sort of thick-necked, historic athletic figure the dad had admired and had by implication compared with woeful distaste to the pencil-necked, big-headed, asthmatic little kid staring up through Coke bottle lenses from his digital keyboard. The show's only rule is that you have to read your thing in the voice of some really silly cartoon character. There are other, rather more exotic, patricidal formats for Asian, Latin, Arab, and European students on select weekend evenings. The consensus is Asian cartoon characters have the silliest voices. Albeit literally sophomoric, Those Were the Legends is a useful drama therapy-type catharsis op. MIT students tend to carry their own special psychic scars. Nerd, geek, dweeb, wonk, fag, weenie, four eyes, spazola, limp dick, needle dick, dickless, dick nose, pencil neck. Getting your violin or laptop TP or entomologist's kill jar broken over your large head by thick-necked kids on the playground. And the show pulls down solid FM ratings. Though a lot of that's due to reverse inertia, like Newton's second law,
like backward shove, from the rabidly popular Madam Psychosis Hour, Monday through Friday, from 0-100 hours to 0-100 hours, which it precedes. YDAU's WYYY late shift student engineer, unfond of any elevator that follows a serpentine or vascular path, eschews the MIT Student Union's elevator. He has an arrival routine, where he skips the front entrances and comes in through the south side's acoustic meatus, and gets a millennial fizzy out of the vending machine in the cephenoid sinus, then descends creaky back wooden stairs from the Massa Intermedia's reading room, down to about the infundibular recess, past the Tech Talk Daily CD-ROM student papers production floor, and the sick chemical smell of the read-only cartridge presses developer, down past the epiglottal Hillel Club's dark and star-doored HQ, past the heavier door, to the tiled lattice of hallways, to the squash and racquetball courts, and one volleyball court, and the airy corpus callosum of 24 high-ceiling tennis courts, endowed by an MIT alum, and now so little used they don't even know now where the nets are, down three more levels to the ghostly clean and lithium-lit studios of FM 109 WYYY-FM, broadcasting for the MIT community and selected points beyond. The studio's walls are pink and laryngeally fissured. His asthma's better down here. The air thin and keen. The tracheal air filters just below the flooring, and the ventilator's air the freshest in the union. The engineer, a work-study graduate student with bagged lungs and occluded pores, settles alone at his panel in the engineer's booth, adjusts a couple needles bob, and soundchecks the only paid personality on the nightly docket, the darkly revered Madam Psychosis, whose cameo shadow is just visible outside the booth's thick glass. Her screen, half obscuring the on-air studio's bank of phones, checking queuing and transition for the Thursday edition. She is hidden from all view by a jointed triptych screen of cream chiffon that glows red and green in the lights of the phone bank and the queuing panel's dials and frames her silhouette. The silhouette is cleanly limbed against the screen, sitting cross-legged in its insectile microphonic headset, smoking. The engineer always has to tighten his own headset's cranial band down from the those-were engineer's mammoth parietal breadth. He activates the intercom and offers to check Madam Psychosis's levels. He requests sound. Anything at all? He hasn't opened his can of pop. There is a long silence during which Madam Psychosis's silhouette doesn't look up from something she looks like she's collating at her little desk. After a while, she makes some little sounds, little plosives to check for roaring sounds and exhalations, a perennial problem in low-budget FM. She makes a long S sound. The student engineer takes a hit from his portable inhaler. She says, "He liked that sort of dreaming music that had the rhythm of long things swinging." The engineer's movements at the panel's dials resemble someone adjusting the heater and sound system while driving. "The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao," she says. The engineer, age 23, has extremely bad skin. "Attractive paraplegic female seeks same. Object?" The windowless laryngeal studio is terribly bright. Nothing casts a shadow. Recessed lit fluorescence with a dual-spectrum lithiumized corona, developed two buildings over and awaiting ONAN patent. The chilly shadowless light of surgical theaters, convenience stores at 0400. The pink wrinkled walls sometimes look more gynecological than anything else. "Like most marriages, theirs was the evolved product of concordance and compromise." The engineer shivers in the bright chill and lights a gasper of his own, and tells Madam Psychosis through the intercom that the whole range of levels is fine. Madam Psychosis is the only WYYY personality who brings in her own headset and jacks,
plus a triptych screen. Over the screen's left section are four clocks set for different zones, plus a numberless disc someone hung for a joke, to designate the annularized Great Concavity's no time. The EST clock's trackable hand carves off the last few seconds from the 5 minutes of dead air Madame Psychosis's contract stipulates gets to precede her show. You can see her silhouette putting out the cigarette very methodically. She cues tonight's synthesized bumper and theme music. The engineer flicks a lever and pumps the music up the coaxial medulla, and through the amps and boosters, hacked into the crawl spaces above the high, false ceiling of the Corpus Callosum's idle tennis courts, and up and out the aerial that protrudes from the gray and bulbous surface of the Union's roof. Institutional design has come a ways from IMPAY, MIT's near-new student union, off the corner of Ames and Memorial Drive, East Cambridge, is one enormous cerebral cortex of reinforced concrete and polymer compounds.
60.
Madame Psychosis is smoking again, listening, head cocked. Her tall screen will leak smoke for her show's whole hour. The student engineer is counting down from 5. On an outstretched hand, he can't see how she sees. And as pinky meets palm, she says what she said for 3 years of midnights, an opening bit that Mario Incandenza, the least cynical person in the history of Enfield, Massachusetts, across the river, listening faithfully, finds, for all its black cynicism, terribly compelling. Her silhouette leans and says, "And lo, for the earth was empty of form and void, and darkness was all over the face of the deep. And we said, look at that fucker dance." A toneless male voice is then cued in to say it's 60 minutes, more or less, with Madame Psychosis on YYY-109, largest whole prime on the FM band. The different sounds are encoded and pumped by the student engineer up to the building's corpus and out the roof's aerial. This aerial, low watt, has been rigged by the station's EM weenies to tilt and spin, not unlike a centrifugal theme park-type ride, spraying the signal in all directions. Since the BS 1966 Hunt Act, the low-watt fringes of the FM band are the only part of the wireless spectrum still licensed for public broadcast. The deep water green of FM tuners all over the campus's labs and dorms, and barnacle clots of grad apartments, align themselves slowly toward the spatter's center, moving toward the dial's right, a little creepily, like plants toward light they can't even see. Ratings are minor league by the pre-interlaced broadcast standards of yore, but they are rock-solid consistent. Audience demand for Madame Psychosis has been, from the very start, inelastic. The aerial, inclined at about the angle of a 3-kilometer cannon, spins in a blurred ellipse. Its rotary base is elliptical because that's the only shape the EM weenies could rig a mold for. Obstructed on all sides by the tall buildings of East Cambridge and Commercial Drive and Sirius downtown, though, only a couple thin pie slices of signal escape MIT proper. For example, through the PE department gap of barely used lacrosse and soccer fields between the philology and low-temp physics complexes on Memorial Drive, and then across the florid purple nighttime breadth of the historic Charles River, then through the heavy flow of traffic on Starro Drive on the Chuck's other side, so that by the time the signal laps at Upper Brighton and Enfield, you need almost surveillance-grade antennation to filter it in, out of the EM miasma of cellular and interconsole phone transmissions and TP's EM auras that crowd the FM fringes from every side. Unless, that is, your tuner is lucky enough to be located at the apex of a tall and more or less denuded hill in Enfield, in which case you find yourself right in YYY's centrifugal line of fire. Madame Psychosis eschews chatty openings and contextual filler. Her hour is compact and no-nonsense. After the music fades, her shadow holds collated sheets up and riffles them slightly, so the sound of paper is broadcast. "Obesity," she says. Obesity with hypogonadism. Also morbid obesity. Nodular leprosy with leonine facies. The engineer can see her silhouette lift a cup as she pauses, which reminds him of the millennial fizzy in his book bag. She says, the acromegalic and hypokeratocystic, the enuretic, this year of all years, the spasmodically torticolic. The student engineer, a predoctoral transuranial metallurgist, working off massive GSL debt, locks the levels and fills out the left side of his timesheet and ascends with his book bag through a triage of interneural stairways with Semitic ideograms and developer smell, and past snack bar and billiard hall and modem banks and extensive student counseling offices around the rostral lamina, all the little-used, many-stared neuroform way up to the artery-red fire door of the union's rooftop, leaving Madame Psychosis, as is S.O.P., alone with her show and screen and the shadowless chill. She's mostly alone in there when she's on air. Every so often there's a guest, but the guest will usually get introduced and then not say anything. The monologues seem both pre-associative and intricately structured, not unlike nightmares. There's no telling what'll be up on a given night. If there's one even remotely consistent theme, it's maybe film and film cartridges. Early and mostly Italian, neorealist and mostly German, expressionist celluloid film. Never new wave. Thumbs up on Peterson Broughton and Dali Boonwell, and down on Darren Hamid. Passionate about Antonioni's slower stuff and some Russian guy named Tarkovsky. Sometimes Ozu and Bresson. Odd affection for the hoary dramaturgy of one Sir Herbert Tree. Bizarre Kalesque admiration for Goremeisters Peckinpah, De Palma, Tarantino. Positively poisonous on the subject of Fellini's 8½. Exceptionally conversant with regard to avant-garde celluloid and avant and après-garde digital cartridges. Anti-confluential cinema. Brutalism. Found drama, etc.
61.
Also highly literate on U.S. sports, football in particular, which fact the student engineer finds dissonant. Madam takes one phone call per show at random. Mostly, she solos. The show kind of flies itself. She could do it in her sleep, behind the screen. Sometimes she seems very sad. The engineer likes to monitor the broadcast from a height, the union's rooftop, summer sun and winter wind. The more correct term for an asthmatic's inhaler is nebulizer. The engineer's graduate research specialty is the carbonated, translithium particles created and destroyed billions of times a second in the core of a cold fusion ring. Most of the lithioids can't be smashed or studied and exist mostly to explain gaps and incongruities in annulation equations. Once last year, Madame Psychosis had the student engineer write out the home lab process for turning uranium oxide powder into good old fissionable U-235. Then she read it on the air between a Baraka poem and a critique of the Steeler defense's double-slot secondary. It's something a bright high schooler could cook and took less than 3 minutes to read on air and didn't involve one classified procedure or one piece of hardware not gettable from any decent chemical supply outlet in Boston. But there was no small unpleasantness about it from the MIT administration, which, it's well known, MIT is in bed with defense. The hot fuel recipe was the one bit of verbal intercourse the engineers had with Madame Psychosis that didn't involve straight levels and cues. The union's soft latex polymer roof is cerebrally domed and a cloudy Piamatter pink, except in spots where it's eroded down to pasty gray, and everywhere textured, the bulging rooftop, with sulci and bulbous convolutions. From the air it looks wrinkled. From the roof's fire door, it's an almost nauseous system of serpentine trenches, like waterslides in hell. The Union itself, the late A.Y. V.F. Rickey's summum opus, is a great hollow brain frame, an endowed memorial to the North American seat of very high tech, and is not as ghastly as out-of-towners suppose it must be. Though the vitrially inflated balloon eyes, deorbited and hung by twined blue cords from the second floor's optic chiasmi to flank the wheelchair-accessible front ramp, take a bit of getting used to. And some, like the engineer, never do get comfortable with them and use the less garish auditory side doors. And the abundant sulcus fissures and gyrus bulges of the slick latex roof make rain drainage complex and footing chancy at best. So there's not a whole lot of recreational strolling up here, although a kind of safety balcony of skull-colored polybutylene resin, which curves around the midbrain from the inferior frontal sulcus to the parietal occipital sulcus, a halo-ish ring at the level of, like, eaves, demanded by the Cambridge Fire Department over the heated, chromomatic protests of topological Rickeyites over in the architecture department, which the MIT administration, trying to placate Rickeyites and CFD fire marshal both, had had the pre-molded resin injected with dyes to render it the distinctively icky brown shot off-white of living skull, so that the balcony resembles at once corporeal bone and numinous aura, which balcony means that even the worst latex slip-and-slide off the steeply curved cerebrum's edge would mean a fall of only a few meters to the broad butylene platform, from which a Venus blue emergency ladder can be detached and lowered to extend down past the superior temporal gyrus and pons and abducent to hook up with the polyurethane bacillar stem artery and allow a safe shimmy down to the good old oblongata just outside the rubberized meatus at ground zero. Topside in the bitter river wind, wearing a khaki parka with a fake fur fringe, the student engineer makes his way and settles into the first intraparietal sulcus that catches his fancy, makes a kind of nest in the soft trench. The convoluted latex is filled with those little non-FHC styrofoam peanuts everything industrially soft is filled with, and the PM outer surface gives, rather like one of those old beanbag chairs of more innocent times. Settles in, and back with his millennial fizzy, an inhaler and cigarette and pocket-sized Heathkit digital FM band receiver under a high CO night sky that makes the stars' points look extra sharp. The Boston PM is 10 degrees Celsius. The post-central sulcus he sits in is just outside the circumference of the YYY aerial's high-speed spin. So 5 meters overhead, its tip's aircraft light describes a blurred oval, vascularly hued. His FM receiver is power cells, tested daily against the low-temp lab's mercuric resistors, are fresh. The wooferless tuners sound tinny and crisp, so that Madam sounds like a faithful but radically miniaturized copy of her studio self. Those with saddle noses, those with atrophic limbs, and yes, chemists and pure math majors, also those with atrophic necks. Sclerodema adulterum. Them that seep, the serodermatotic. Come one, come all, this circular says. The hydrocephalic, the tibescent, and chaquetic, and anorexic. The Bragg's diseased, in their heavy red rinds of flesh. The derminally wine-stained, or carbuncular, or steatocryptotic, or, God forbid, all three. Marin-Amat syndrome, you say? Come on down. The psoriatic, the eczematically shunned, and the scrofulodermic, bell-shaped styatopygiacs in your special slacks. Afflictees of pityriasis rosea. It says here, come all ye hateful, blessed are the poor in body, for they... The pulsing aircraft alert light of the aerial is magenta, a sharp and much closer star now, with his fingers laced behind his head, reclined and gazing upward, listening the centrifugal whirl's speed making its tips light trail color across the eyes. The light's oval a bloody halo over the very barest of all possible heads. Madame Psychosis has done UHID stuff before, once or twice. He is listening to her read four levels below the oblongated recess that becomes the heating shaft's nubbin of spine, ad-lib-style reading from one of the PR circulars of the Union of the Hideously and Improbably Deformed, an agnostic-style 12-step support group deal for what it calls the aesthetically challenged.
62.
She sometimes reads circulars and catalogs and PR-type things, though not regularly. Some things take several successive shows to get through. Ratings, stay solid. Listeners hang in. The engineer's pretty sure he'd hang in even if he weren't paid to. He does like to settle into a sulcus and smoke slowly and exhale up past the blurred ready lips of the aerial, monitoring. Madam's themes are at once unpredictable and somehow rhythmic. More like probability waves for subhadronics than anything else.
63.
The student engineer has never once seen Madame Psychosis enter or leave WYYY. She probably takes the elevator. It's 22 October in the ONAN-ite year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Like most marriages, Averill and the late James Incandenza's was an evolved product of concordance and compromise. And the scholastic curriculum at ETA is the product of negotiated compromises between Averill's academic hard assery and James's and Stitt's keen sense of athletic pragmatics. It is because of Averill, who quit MIT entirely and went down to halftime at Brandeis, and even turned down an extremely plummy-type stipended fellowship at Radcliffe's Bunting Institute that first year, to design and assume the helm of ETA's curriculum, that the Enfield Tennis Academy is the only athletic-focused type school in North America that still adheres to the trivium and quadrivium of the hard-ass classical LAS tradition, and thus one of the very few extant sports academies that makes a real stab at being a genuine pre-college school, and not just an iron curtainish jock factory.
64.
But Stitt never let Incandenza forget what the place was supposed to be about. And so Averill's flinty Mensana pedagogy wasn't diluted so much as ad valorumized, pragmatically focused toward the corpore potus type goals kids were coming up the hill to give their childhoods for. Some ETA twists Averill allowed into the classic LAS path are, for example, that the seven subjects of the T and Q are mixed and not divided into quadrivial upper class versus trivial ephebic. That ETA geometry classes pretty much ignore the study of closed figures, excepting rectangles, to concentrate, also except for Thorpe's trigonometry of cubes, which is elective and mostly aesthetic, for two increasingly brutal semesters on the involution and expansion of bare angles. That the quadrivial requirement of astronomy has, at ETA, become a two-term elementary optics survey, since vision issues are obviously more germane to the game, and since all the hardware required for everything from aphotic to apochromatic lens work were, and are, right there in the lab off the ComEd tunnel. Music's been pretty much bagged. Plus the triviomoid fetish for classical oratory has by now at ETA been converted to a wide range of history and studio courses and various types of entertainment, mostly recorded film. Again, way too much of Incandenza's lavish equipment lying around not to exploit, plus the legally willed and endowed for perpetuity presence on the academic payroll of Mrs. Prickett, Mr. Ogilvy, Mr. Disney R. Leith, and Ms. Soma Richardson Levy O'Brien Chawaf, the late founder director's loyal sound engineer, best boy, production assistant, and third favorite actress, respectively. Plus, also, the six-term entertainment requirement because students hoping to prepare for careers as professional athletes are, by intention, training also to be entertainers, albeit of a deep and special sort, was in Condensa's line, one of the few philosophical points he had to pretty much ram down the throats of both Averill and Stitt, who was pushing hard for some mix of theology and the very grim ethics of Kant. Mario Incandenza has sat in on a back-row stool for every session of an ETA entertainment department offering ever since he was finally, 3 years ago December, asked to disenroll from the Winter Hill Special School in Cambridgeport for cheerfully declining even to try to learn to really read, explaining he'd way rather listen and watch. And he is a fanatical listener-observer. He treats the lavish Tatsuoka Fringe FM band tuner in the living room of the headmaster's house, like kids of three generations past, listening the way other kids watch TP, opting for mono, and sitting right up close to one of the speakers, with his head cocked dog-like, listening, staring into that special pocket of near-middle distance reserved for the serious listener. He really does have to sit right up close to listen to 60 minutes, more or less, when he's over at the headmaster's house, with CT and sometimes Hal, at his mother's late suppers, because Averill has some auditory thing about broadcast sound and gets the howling fantods from any voice that does not exit a living, corporeal head.
65.
And though Averill's made it clear that Mario's free at any time to activate and align the Tatsuoka's ghostly green tuner to whatever he wishes, he keeps the volume so low that he has to be lowered onto a low coffee table and lean in and almost put his ear up against the woofer's tremble and concentrate closely to hear YYY's signal over the conversation in the dining room, which tends to get sort of manically high-pitched toward the end of supper. Averill never actually asks Mario to keep it down. He does it out of unspoken consideration for her thing about sound. Another of her unspoken but stressful things involves issues of enclosure, and the headmaster's house has no interior doors between rooms, and not even much in the way of walls, and the living and dining rooms are separated only by a vast multi-leveled tangle of houseplants in pots, and on little stools of different heights, and arrayed under hanging UV lamps of an intensity that tends to give the diners strange little patterns of tan that differ according to where someone usually sits at the table. Al sometimes complains privately to Mario that he gets more than enough UV during the day, thank you very much. The plants are incredibly lush and hale and sometimes threaten to block off the whole easement from dining to living room, and the rope-handled Brazilian machete CT had mounted on the wall by the tremulous china case has stopped really being a joke. The moms calls the houseplants her green babies, and she has a rather spectacular thumb, plant-wise, for a Canadian. The leucodermatic, the xanthodantic, the maxillofacially swollen, those with distorted orbits of all kinds. Get out from under the sun's cove lighting, is what this says. Come in from the spectral rain. Madame Psychosis's broadcast accent is not Boston. There are R's, for one thing, and there is no cultured Cambridge stutter. It's the accent of someone who spent time either losing a southern lilt or cultivating one. It's not flat and twangy like Stice's, and it's not a drawl like the people at Gainesville's Academy. Her voice itself is sparely modulated and strangely empty, as if she were speaking from inside a small box. It's not bored, or laconic, or ironic, or tongue-in-cheek. The basilisk-breathed and pyoreic. It's reflective but not judgmental, somehow. Her voice seems low-depth familiar to Mario, the way certain childhood smells will strike you as familiar. And oddly sad. All ye pyronic or pteritoidal, the phrenologically malformed, the suppuratively lesioned, the endocrinologically malodorous of whatever ilk. Run, don't walk, on down. The acerbulous-nosed, the radically ectomied, the morbidly diaphoretic with a hanky in every pocket, the chronically granulomatous. The ones, it says here, the ones the cruel call two-baggers. One bag for your head, one bag for the observer's head in case your bag falls off. The hated and dateless and shunned who keep to the shadows. Those who undress only in front of their pets. The, quote, aesthetically challenged. Leave your lazarettes and oubliettes, I'm reading this right here, your closets and cellars and teepee tableaus. Find nurturing and support and the inner resources to face your own unblinking sight, is what this goes on to say. A bit overheatedly, maybe. Is it our place to say? It says here, hugs, not uggs. It says, come don the veil of the type and token. Come learn to love what's hidden inside, to hold and cherish. The almost unbelievably thick-ankled, the kyphotic and lordotic, the irremediably cellulitic. It says, progress, not perfection. It says, never perfection. The fatally pulchritudinous, welcome. The actionizing, side by side with the medusoid, the papuled, the macular, the albinic. Medusas and odalisques both, come find common ground, all meeting rooms windowless. That's in italics, all meeting rooms windowless. Plus the music she's cued for this inflectionless reading is weirdly compelling. You can never predict what it will be, but over time some kind of pattern emerges, a trend or rhythm. Tonight's background fits somehow, as she reads. There's not any real forwardness to it. You don't sense it's straining to get anywhere. The thing it makes you see as she reads is something heavy, swinging slowly at the end of a long rope. It's minor key enough to be eerie against the empty lilt of the voice and the clinks of tines and china, as Mario's relations eat turkey salad and steamed croziers, and drink lager and milk and vin blanc from Hull over behind the plants bathed in purple light. Mario can see the back of the mom's head high above the table, and then over to the left, Hal's bigger right arm, and then Hal's profile when he lowers it to eat. There's a ball by his plate. The ETA players seem to need to eat 6 or 7 times a day. Hal and Mario had walked over for 2100 supper at the headmaster's house, after Hal had read something for Mr. Leith's class, and then disappeared for about half an hour while Mario stood supported by his police lock and waited for him. Mario rubs his nose with the heel of his hand. Metempsychosis has an unironic but generally gloomy outlook on the universe in general. One of the reasons Mario's obsessed with her show is that he's somehow sure Metempsychosis cannot herself sense the compelling beauty and light she projects over the air somehow. He has visions of interfacing with her and telling her she'd feel a lot better if she'd listened to her own show, he bets. Metempsychosis is one of only 2 people Mario would love to talk to, but would be scared to try. The word periodic pops into his head. Hey, Hal, he calls across the plants. Like for months in the spring semester of YDPAH, she referred to her own program as Madam's Downer Lit Hour, and read depressing book after depressing book. Good Morning, Midnight, and Maggie, A Girl of the Streets, and Giovanni's Room, and Under the Volcano, plus a truly ghastly Brett Ellis period during Lent, in a monotone, really slowly, night after night. Mario sits on the low little Van der Rohe knockoff coffee table with bowed legs, the table, with his head cocked right up next to the speaker and his claws in his lap. His toes tend to point inward when he sits. The background music is both predictable and, within that predictability, surprising. It's periodic. It suggests expansion without really expanding. It leads up to the exact kind of inevitability it denies. It is heavily digital, but with something of a choral bouquet,
but unhuman. Mario thinks of the word haunting, like in a haunting echo of thus and such. Madame Psychosis's cued music, which the student engineer never chooses or even sees her bring in, is always terribly obscure.
66.
But often, just as queerly powerful and compelling as her voice and show itself, the MIT community feels. It tends to give you the feeling there's an in-joke that you and she alone are in on. Very few devoted WYYY listeners sleep well Monday through Friday. Mario has horizontal breathing trouble sometimes, but other than that, he sleeps like a babe. Averill and Condenza still sticks with the old Lillet region practice of taking just tea and nibbles at U.S. supper time, and waiting to eat seriously until right before bed. Cultured Canadians tend to think vertical digestion makes the mind unkeen. Some of Oren and Mario and Hal's earliest memories are of nodding off at the dining room table and being gently carried by a very tall man to bed. This was in a different house. Madame Psychosis's cued musics stir very early memories of Mario's father. Averill is more than willing to take some good-natured guff about her inability to eat before, like, 22-30 hours. Prandial music holds little charm or associations for Hal, who, like most of the kids on double daily drills, makes fists around his utensils and eats like a wild dog. Nor are excluded the utterly noseless, or the hideously wall and cross-eyed, nor either the ergotic of St. Anthony, the leprous, the very celiformally eruptive, or even the sarcomid of Kaposi. Hal and Mario proudly eat/listen late over at the headmaster's house twice a week. Averill likes to see them outside the awkward formality of her position at ETA. CT's the same at home and office. Both Averill and Tavis's bedrooms are on the second floor, as a matter of fact, right next to each other. The only other room up there is Averill's personal study, with a big color Xerox of M. Hamilton as Oz's West Witch on the door, and custom fiber wiring for a tri-modem TP console. A stairway runs from her study down the back side of the headmaster's house, north, down to a tributary tunnel leading to the main tunnel to ComAd, so Averill can commute over to ETA below ground. The headmaster's house tunnel connects with the main at a point between the pump room and ComAd, meaning Averill never, like, hunches idly past the pump room, which, fact, Hal obviously endorses. Late suppers at the headmaster's house for Hal are limited by Delenn to twice a week tops, because they get him excused from dawn drills, which also means late-night mischief possibilities. Sometimes they bring Canada's John, no relation, Wayne, over with them, whom Mrs. I likes and speaks to animatedly, even though he rarely says anything the whole time he's there, and also eats like a wild dog, sometimes neglecting utensils altogether. Averill also likes it when Axford comes. Axford has a hard time eating, and she likes to exhort him to eat. Very rarely anymore does Hal bring Pemulus or Jim Strzok, to whom Averill is so faultlessly, brittly polite that the dining room's tension raises hair. Whenever Averill parts ficus leaves to check, Mario's still hunched, pigeon-toed, and cocked in the same RCA Victorish posture, with a little horizontal forehead crease that means he's either listening or thinking hard. The multiple amputee. The prosthetically malmatched. The snaggle-toothed, wattled, weak-chinned, and walrus-cheeked. The palate-clefted. The really large-pored. The excessively but not necessarily lycanthropically hirsute, the pin-headed, the convulsively teretic, the Parkinsonianly tremulous, the stunted.